This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. District Council 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and more than 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available on podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. You can stay in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net, and call our hotline, 212-815-7555, to keep abreast of union activities. If you have any comments about our show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. Tonight, we are paying homage to Les Payne, one of the giants of journalism, a former columnist, really part of the heart and soul of Newsday. It's hard to say enough about the man. Joining us by phone to discuss his legacy is Quartz Global News editor John Mancini, who's also former editor at Newsday, who worked with Les at Newsday for many years. Welcome to the show, sir.
All right. Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
Les Payne was one of the lions of journalism. He died 1 year to the day after Jimmy Breslin passed away. I thought there was some iron. I don't know what there was in that, but clearly a passing in time is taking place. And let's talk about what Les Payne meant to journalism in the city and in the country.
Well, you know, it's hard to overstate his importance, actually. As you said in the introduction, he was a giant of journalism. You know, for many reasons, notwithstanding his fantastic work reporting in the U.S., stories like the Patty Hearst case, in Africa, where he was, you know, summarily escorted out of at least six countries, and, you know, jailed at different times, did groundbreaking work in South Africa. In addition to that, and on top of all of that, he was a pioneer as a black man in American newsrooms. When he joined Newsday in 1969, there were very few black reporters anywhere. He made it his job through his life and career to make sure that that changed. And that was not just about who was in the newsroom, but also how major media organizations cover the news here, to be inclusive, to make sure that everyone's voices are heard, that all stories are told. And, you know, Les himself said it, his primary mission was to battle apartheid in the United States, which, you know, he grew up to age 12 and was born in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, you know, which is at the center of the Deep South and home to the KKK, and moved as a 12-year-old to Hartford, Connecticut, and encountered the racism of the 50s and 60s, well entrenched in the North, something his mother, Josephine, thought she was escaping by leaving the South. And, you know, Les backed off from no challenge at any age. And we heard at the service at Abyssinian Baptist Church this week that, you know, he, as a teenager, he led a boycott of a restaurant that had all of its black employees in the back, but none in the front of the house, and that eventually led to the sale of the restaurant to a black owner. But you know, so he was not an activist; he was a journalist, and one of his great exclusives was breaking the Tawana Brawley case. You might recall a young black woman in the area north of New York City who had claimed to have been raped and attacked, and scrawled with racist messages, etc. And Al Sharpton had taken, and others had taken up her cause, and when Les got on the case, he discovered, in fact, that she had made up her story. And he had no qualms about reporting that. It did not put African-American figure in the news in a good light, and African-American leaders, some of them, in a good light, but he had no fear of doing that, and his passion was the truth. And he made it easy to understand the ridiculousness of racism, really, and bigotry and prejudice by really putting it in simple terms: are we being fair? And that meant, are we being fair in the newsroom? Are we being fair in our coverage? Are we being fair in our personal interactions? Are we treating each other as we would treat anyone else, no matter what their background is or how they arrived there? So he was someone who was had, you know, he just stands above in so many ways, both as a peerless journalist and then someone who made sure that, you know, America really held or holds to its ideals.
I found there's a quote from you when Payne retired in 2006. You, as editor of Newsday, said Payne had produced, quote, a weekly column that was so strong, so provocative, and generated so much hate mail that Newsday editors got to know the names of all the Suffolk County Police Department's bomb-sniffing dogs.
Right. Now, that line actually comes from Tony Marrow, who was editor of Newsday for many years before I was. And
well, brother, you got
that. No, but just to make it clear that who was there.
Okay.
But yeah, so Les, you know, there was a lot of venom generated by Les's column, which he started in the early 80s when he was national editor and then national and foreign editor at Newsday, overseeing those operations. And the point Tony was making there was that, you know, he was speaking to a largely white audience on Long Island. And week after week, pointing out what the hypocrisy of how people live, not just in suburban New York, but across the nation here, and talking about discrimination in housing, and not just discrimination, but people being burned out of their homes if they moved into a segregated place where black people had not lived before. He talked about his own experience in being steered to his home on Long Island, where he raised three children and lived with his wife. So again, I think one of the great aspects of his approach was to make it quite simple for the white people, frankly, and focus on fairness and ask them how they like to be treated. And put aside, you can carry your bigotry to your grave if you wish, but you do not have, you have a constitutional right to that, in fact, but you do not have any right to impose that in any public sphere on anyone. And that means renting a home, selling a home, offering a job, any of those things.
You talked, it was quite a remarkable service, and it was quite a remarkable day because it was the same day that the firefighter Michael Davidson was being honored throughout the city. So there was a real sense as you got into the church and you were hearing about what was happening, at least when I was hearing about what was happening downtown, there was a real sense of something passing. And the folks in the church at Abyssinian, I saw Vernon Jordan, I saw Charlene Hunter Gault, David Dinkins was there. It was truly, you did have a sense of the passage of time, and that there was a lot of, we've come so far and yet not far enough. And Les was an interesting character. I did not know him very well, but I do know that when you hung out with Les, he did not suffer fools easily. And and you spoke very eloquently at the at the service about what it was like to spend day after day, you know, chewing the fat with him and what those conversations were about. Talk a little bit about what those conversations were like. And
I'm sorry. I had the great fortune to work with Les very closely for about 4 years in Kew Gardens, and our relationship, a working relationship, and our personal relationship continued after that. And you know, he opened his heart to me. And when people do that, it's somewhat a rare thing. And you know, they see something in you that they connect with. And you know, we talk mostly about family life and being a husband and a father, and what it means to be a man, and how to do that in a way that you know, you direct your children but not control them, and you make space for your partner in life. But at the same time, being present at all times. So, it was a very deep and meaningful relationship for me, and it's one I'll carry with me forever. And he was that way with a lot of people. You know, a lot of people did not know that we all had these individual relationships with Les, and whether it was a mentorship through NABJ, the National Association of Black Journalists, which he was a founder of, or many other things he did. He taught at Columbia for a while. He had an ongoing mentorship with many, many, I'd say thousands of people probably, in NABJ and beyond. So he was, you know, a man in full in the truest sense, and he was not afraid to share that, and he was not afraid to be vulnerable and express his emotions as well. I mean, to me, for all the stridency of his column, and he wrote in a very particular and deliberate way, in a very kind of legalistic way. His was not about opinion. He was shining a light on different standards being applied to different people and how that was un-American and unconstitutional, whether it was action by government or private interest. At the same time, he was someone who, you know, devoted to jazz and a very, very discriminating art collector. And his collections have been shown in museums across the country here. A big baseball fan. So all of those things made him someone who, as by example, showed people you can be your full self. That really was his lesson, I think, that he imparted, whether consciously or unconsciously, to everyone. You strive for professional excellence, but at the same time, we have full and vibrant lives, and don't be afraid to live your life.
He also served 6 years in the United States Army and worked for wrote speeches for General William Westmoreland. And I think his Army career really helped shape a lot of who he was and how he felt about the country. And I was thinking about that because so many people made reference to it at the service about what Les Payne thought about this country. And, you know, I remember a quote from James Baldwin that said, "I love America more than any other place on earth, and therefore I claim the right to criticize her perpetually." And there's perhaps some of that in his work and in his in what shaped him.
Absolutely. And, he would not claim that his Army service gave him more rights than anyone else or less. But he did have it, and it was a part of his life, and it reflected his belief in the system, actually at some point being true and real and of service to the citizens of this country, all of them. And he would protect and defend your right not to serve in that capacity and do other things that benefit society. So, but it did, you know, Les always said that he was, and someone said this at the service too, it's not about the fight, it's about winning. So he was not one to get involved in petty disagreements and things day to day that may not make a difference in the end. He would only insert himself into situations as a leader when it was necessary. And in a loyally way, he never asked a question he did not know the answer to in
yeah,
those
right.
situations. And he had a very legalistic mind along with his moral depth. And that's what truly gave him great impact, both personally and professionally.
We only have exactly 2 minutes left. Talk, if you will, just a little bit about the state of the art today, in your opinion, where we are and how far we've come in terms of integrating the newsrooms and what newsrooms look like. You've got a minute and 45 seconds.
Okay. Well, I mean, part of that is, you know, and you alluded to it earlier, that, you know, the passing of people like Jimmy Breslin and Les Payne and not so long ago Don Force and others who were so big in the newspaper world really mark a change completely. It's not just the passing of these men, but also a change, the turning the page in history on newspapers, so to speak. So I think with that, we do have a bit of a crisis in media, in mass media, in journalism, in terms of diversity and inclusion, because newspapers, you know, as they were imploding, have really come to the point of understanding deeply. I think newspaper companies, the biggest ones, and management leadership did understand the need for diversity and inclusion and had put a lot of programs in place to do that. The digital world has yet to do that, and the digital world, except for a few places, doesn't have the same scale that newspapers had collectively across the country to really kind of make things right in that way. So I think it's incumbent upon those of us opportunity here now to make sure we are as inclusive as possible. And of course, you know, things have broadened beyond just race when you talk about diversity and inclusion. And we're much more aware as a people, I think, on that. But I'm not sure we've employed all the techniques necessary to make sure that we're serving the audience and serving the profession in the way we should.
John Mancini is the global news editor of Quartz. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us tonight about Les Payne.
Really, really appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. Last week, AFSCME President Lee Saunders and the Oscar award-winning filmmaker Martin Scorsese, also with the Library of Congress, joined and had a press conference to announce the Film Foundation's partnership with AFSCME to educate young people about labor and civil rights through classic films. This is a unique partnership. I know this is the first time AFSCME has gotten involved in something like this. And we were there, and we wanted to share it with you. So the first speaker will be Martin Scorsese, followed by Lee Saunders of AFSCME. So take a listen.
But we're here today to introduce a brand new curriculum that explores pretty much our most cherished idea, and that is a democracy. In a time of division, conflict, anger, seems to be defining this particular moment in our culture. And that's why we felt it was so important to create a curriculum, a body in which they could study, built around movies that span the history of American cinema and that look squarely at the struggles and the violent disagreements and the tragedies in our history, not to mention, you know, hypocrisies, false promises. But also, these things have to embody the best of America. That is, the greatest hope and the ideal, the great hopes and the ideals of America. And the name of our new story of movies curriculum, Portraits of America, Democracy on Film. That came from downtown, a lower working class family. Not educated, no books in the house. And I sort of learned a lot about citizenship and American ideals aside from the schools I was attending, but primarily, really, from a lot of the movies I saw. And you take The Grapes of Wrath, John Ford's adaptation of John Steinbeck's novel, Exploitation of Labor, done in a very beautiful, extraordinary, moving film. When I say beautiful, that involves the camera moves, the actors, the blacks and the whites, and all of this together and how they form these images, because they're indelible. It's the exploitation of labor in times of national emergency. Billy Wilder's movie Ace in the Hole, which was completely rejected by the audience at the time, is now, of course, a classic. And it really was brutal in showing me very clearly, and don't forget, this is the beginnings of television, the Today Show and things like that, but it showed me very clearly that human tragedy could be milked, you know, relentlessly by heartless media. Otto Preminger's Advise and Consent. And this actually is amazing, and the use of widescreen, too, because it showed you how the system of government works, in a way, in a place within a dramatic narrative. Okay. Kazan's extremely personal, Ilya Kazan's extremely personal, like a handmade film, although if that's handmade, it's, I don't know. I don't know if handmade's the wrong word, but beautiful film that he made with all those people, including Haskell Wexler on camera. The epic America, America, which is about the immigrant experience and the great American promise that has brought so many millions of people to these shores, including Kazan's family and my own. Then you have Kazan's film with, that he, Bud Schulberg wrote, a remarkable picture, A Face in the Crowd, which was also completely rejected by the audience at that time. Big disappointment in the box office. Now it's a classic, of course. It looks right into the heart of another issue, of course, that we're facing right now, and that is the convergence of politics, mass media, cult of personality, the danger of that. That's not even to mention some of the other films that we have in the program. Lion is in the Streets, one that's not in the program, All the King's Men, all that sort of thing. So the range of issues and history and the sheer breadth of artistry in this curriculum are absolutely amazing to me, and so is the richness and the wealth of these precious images of people and places. And we feel that Portraits of America, Democracy on Film can inspire teachers and their students. And this is the key. The movies always inspired me to go further, learn about this other culture, learn about our country, learn about people, whether it was Grapes of Wrath or was Sajid Ray films from India. And it will definitely, we hope, inspire teachers and students to go further and deeper into an engagement with our history, our politics, and our cinema.
Thank you so much, Marty. So now we'll hear from Lee Saunders.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody. We represent 1.6 million proud public service workers in New York City and all across the country. If you think of public service, you should think of AFSCME, because we represent almost every occupation in the public service, whether it's a sanitation worker, a daycare provider, home care worker, doctors, nurses, health care, administrative, highway corrections officers. We represent those workers all across the country. Our union story, and that's why this is so important to all of us, this gathering today, our union story of service and struggle, of solidarity and of sacrifice, is in many ways the story of American democracy in this country. We were founded in the 1930s in the state of Wisconsin when a group of state workers got together and demanded that they have the ability to sit at the table and to negotiate over wages and benefits. They wanted to get rid of the patronage system that existed where folks could be fired for no reason at all. So they formed our union. They formed AFSCME, and that was the beginning. That was the life of our union, the beginning of our lives. Now, I want to tell you one story that embodies our core values and vision in our relentless pursuit of social justice. Next week, we will be commemorating in Memphis, Tennessee, the 50th anniversary of the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Now, a lot of people know that he traveled to Memphis and that he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, but a lot of people don't know the reasons why. Dr. King traveled to Memphis, Tennessee to support 1,300 African-American sanitation workers, AFSCME members of Local 1733, who went on strike to have a seat at that table, who went on strike not only for better wages and working conditions and to be recognized, to have the city recognize their union as their bargaining agent. Those workers went on strike for dignity. They went on strike for respect. In the Deep South, in Memphis, Tennessee, in 1968. We commemorate that day next week. But the reason that Dr. King came and the reason that that strike began was the fact that two sanitation workers were killed on February 1st, 1968. They were killed in a sanitation truck, crushed to death because of faulty equipment. Two sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. And after those two deaths, those 1,300 brave men decided that they were sick and tired of being sick and tired. So they went on strike. And Dr. King was planning the Poor People's March at that time, if you recall. And he took notice of the strike in Memphis, Tennessee. And he decided that he must travel there. He must make his voice heard and support that struggle. Even when some of his advisors were telling him not to go because he was so involved in the Poor People's March. But he ignored that advice, and he traveled to Memphis on numerous occasions because he understood the connection between labor rights and civil rights and economic rights and human rights. And he lent his voice to support those workers who went on strike. We know what happened there. Dr. King gave his famous speech at Mason Temple, the mountaintop speech. And then he was assassinated the next day. We can never forget our history. We can never forget that story because it is not only a part of AFSCME's history, but it is a part of American history. That's why this partnership is so important to all of us, because we have to retell those stories through film. We have to talk about our history so our young people understand the struggles, the blood, sweat, and tears that happened back then. People risking their lives every single day to simply have a seat at the table. This is what it's all about. And this is why we believe that this partnership is so important. You know, we've come a long way since 1968, but we honestly believe that we still have a long way to go. And we need to educate our young people and talk about their history so they understand where they have got to go, so they have a clear path for their future. Now, movies don't just entertain. Movies can educate and movies can inspire. No medium has a greater ability to move us to action than film. Movies create community and help us understand our national identity. Because I love movies, because I love my union, because I believe improving our democracy is a duty that we all share, I'm proud to be a partner. My union is proud to be a partner of this project. I would only hope that maybe someone might produce a movie about that strike in Memphis, Tennessee, to tell the story, to tell the story of the important day that existed then and the connection that brings us all together. We're hopeful that we will do that in the schools across the country. We're hopeful that students will understand in a stronger and better way the history, their history, our country's history, in moving this democracy forward.
That was Lee Saunders and Oscar-winning filmmaker Martin Scorsese talking about a new partnership to educate young people about labor and civil rights through classic films. Before we go, we have several announcements. Find out about the latest issues impacting our union by attending an organizing department meeting at your job site. For dates and locations, call 212-815-1095. You can also find out about issues impacting your community by attending a DC 37 Political Action Community Association near you. For more information, check out the DC 37 website. You can also call the Political Action Department at 212-815-1550. The Education Fund Spring Courses application for classes that begin in April is available at www.dc37.net. For details, call 212-815-1700. And the Municipal Employee Legal Services reminds you that they provide legal representation to members when applying for citizenship. For more information, call 212-815-1818. We're just about done. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. Contact us, stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Till next time, ciao.